Hey, this is Kelly Corrigan, and today I'm wondering about forgiveness, which has to be one of the most advanced emotional achievements we can hit as people. I started my research on Medium, my production partner for this series, and I read about the pros and cons of various types of forgiveness. There was some pretty juicy stuff on there, I must say. Today, we're talking about three astonishing stories of forgiveness that were damn near unimaginable to both me and my thought partner for this whole series, Wanda Holland Green, an educator, a thought leader, and a world-class girlfriend. So with me is Wanda again, wonderful Wanda.
Hello.
I want to start by reminding everybody that Wanda is a sucker for People magazine, but also a person who loves gospel and loves Lord Neil Hurston, pretty much defines like the well-rounded soul. What we decided to do was sort of look at three astonishing stories of forgiveness and see what there might be for all of us to learn in this examination.
Absolutely.
So the first one that I wanted to tell you about is I'm a big fan of StoryCorps, which is this amazing organization where two people go into a very quiet booth, not unlike what we're doing right now, and ask each other deep questions and answer them. And it's all recorded and it all goes into the Library of Congress. But one of those stories was this woman, Mary Johnson, and her son was killed at a party by another kid named O'Shea Israel. And O'Shea was arrested and sent to jail. And for many years, Mary was heartbroken and furious. But then she became curious about who this kid was. And God bless her, she got in her car and she drove to the penitentiary and she asked to have a meeting with him a dozen years after her son was killed. And she said, he became human to me. This guy, he became real. And when it was time to go, we were both crying. And we stood up and just spontaneously hugged. And he said, I hugged you like you were my mom. She continued to visit him over the years. And they developed this incredible bond. And as he was getting out, she said, I want you to come live next door to me. I want you to take out my trash and come check on me in the snow. And if the electricity goes out, I want you to invite me over to sit by your candle. And it was the most astonishing, beautiful story. So where do you go with something like that, that that's possible?
There's a moment that has to be divine in order for that to happen. I mean, that story is otherworldly, Kelly. And I think the power of this woman's faith, she's a woman of God. I think she would label herself as such. And there's also the moment when she reads that poem about two mothers, and she says, who's the mother of Judas Iscariot? Right. And so I think this is divine intervention, because how do you do that? Her only son is killed, 20 years old, and you're deeply invested in the success of the life of the murderer. That's divine.
To me, I attribute it to time and curiosity. I think 12 years is a really long time to be unhappy and in pain and grieving with anger. I think people grieve forever.
Yeah.
But I think anger hopefully has some kind of timestamp on it, like it runs its course eventually. And then I think curiosity is like this huge superpower. Her wanting to look at this guy, wanting to see what it felt like to talk to him, wanting to hear his voice, wanting to ask him questions about where he was raised.
Wanting to know his story.
That is an incredible superpower. So you're deconstructing it and saying divine intervention. If I'm deconstructing it, then I'm saying it's time and curiosity. And then maybe what you would say is, where do you think curiosity comes from, Kelly? Maybe that's the divine insertion of something like curiosity that could really heal so many people and in so doing the world.
But I think to the question, can you forgive someone who doesn't ask for it? This seems to me to be a perfect example of that, because he didn't knock on her door. She needed to forgive him to free herself, right? That's what I think. I think she needed to live without the constraints of anger. I do think that she was suffering. And by forgiving him, she released herself from a life that was less than optimal. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. I think about the power of exposure. that she allowed herself to be exposed to him face to face, that's just very different. That's a very dangerous thing that not everybody does.
Yep. It's one of the things that Bryan Stevenson talks about is proximity. I think that goes alongside curiosity, your word. When you're proximate and curious, watch out. You're going to be transformed.
I know. And I don't know that everybody wants to be transformed in every minute. That's why I wanted to flag time as this incredible ingredient in this.
Yep.
Because we're not always in the mood to transform.
True.
It's interesting to think about the relationship between forgiveness and agency. Mm-hmm. So in the last episode, we talked a lot about recognizing agency, nurturing your sense of agency, allowing agency in one situation to spill over to agency in another situation. Mm-hmm. But I bet in all these three stories that we're going to look at today, there is this deep recognition that this is a choice that is always available to you in any situation.
Yeah. I was listening to someone speak many years ago. It was a minister at a small church in San Francisco. He talked about forgiveness as if you are in a jail cell. You're on the inside. It's locked, but you have the key in your hand. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. That sense of agency. You can actually get out if you do a few things, but a lot of people don't want to be transformed yet. Let's use the growth mindset word from Carol Dweck. Yet. You're not ready yet. And maybe for 12 years, Mary Johnson wasn't ready yet.
A little personal reveal is that I find righteousness very energizing. Anger is a buzz. It's a very different physiological state than the state of forgiveness, which is quieter, mellower.
I was going to say placid.
Yeah, placid, precisely. So the idea that you're in this super jacked up state of righteousness and anger, and a lot of people will meet you there.
Like at a Black Lives Matter protest.
Yeah.
That's the heat that we're seeing in our world, right?
Yes, and people can get each other whipped up into something worse, which is to say less curious, less solution-oriented, just more vitriol. And this is why I really loathe cable news on both sides of the equation. Because I think the primary objective of almost every story and whoever's writing this stuff is to make the audience angry. And I don't think anger is a very productive state from which to try to operate.
Absolutely. Or scared, right?
It's interesting to think that you're in this sort of high energy state of super angry and righteous, and you have all your friends are rallying around you and elevating that state. And then somehow somebody, you or somebody else in your circle that you trust, is going to try to encourage you to override that and come into a more rational state where you can see your choices clearly and maybe make a move.
And that's the pivot I keep wondering about from a political civil rights stance. I believe that, and this metaphor is not mine around heat and light, but I believe that every movement needs the heat. You need the anger. You need the rally cry. You need the people to come together and to be indignant and maybe for a while unforgiving.
Yeah.
And then there's the moment of pivot when you need the light to illuminate the path, to say, now where do we go? How do we begin reconciling? How do we begin moving forward? Do we move from heat to light? Because we need both.
Yeah, I would describe it as emotional to rational.
Mm-hmm.
You need the emotion to generate the political will.
Yes.
The way that the laws get changed is that some set of representatives decides, if I don't do this, I'm not going to get reelected.
Yes.
So whatever that injection of energy into that set of representatives, it's typically a really highly emotional state where there's just relentless messaging coming from your constituents to your representatives until it's undeniable that your job depends on you making a move here.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you've reached that place, then you got to get rational fast. Here is the set of solutions that are workable. Here's how we can move forward. Here's what we can get written into law. So there's this, as you say, this huge pivot.
Yep.
So really interesting segue into the second story of forgiveness that is, I think, for me, the most astonishing, which is what went on in Rwanda after the genocide.
Oh, wow.
So I think 800,000 people were killed in 100 days. which is horrifying. And I think Rwanda is the size of Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
So if 800,000 people were killed in Maryland in the next 3 months or so, I mean, we would be beside ourselves. It would feel like the world was literally coming to an end.
Yeah.
So then you have this country that is stuck in this moment where you could be at war one way or another for the next 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so groups of people got together and started to think about, how do we get at truth and reconciliation? How do we get at a place of forgiveness so that we can have these little communities again? It's just a bunch of villages. So the people are all together. In a given small village, there would easily be people coming out of prison as genocide perpetrators and people in that community who lost people.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes there would be the actual person who killed your child or your mother or your wife living in your tiny village. So there's no way that it can stay like that. It has to be addressed.
Talk about proximity, right?
Mm. Yeah. So I think it was World Vision ran this program, and they put together over 1,000 pairs of perpetrators and victims. And what they said is this perpetrator had done their time. I mean, I don't know what's enough time to pay that debt back, but they had done some amount of time, and then they were being released back into the community. And they had this law of gachacha, the law of the grass hill.
Yep.
So they had the perpetrator say specifically and exactly and unequivocally what he did and to whom.
Mm-hmm.
And then the surviving family members could choose to forgive or not. And sometimes the stories were so horrific that the surviving family member would go to a mental hospital for 10 days, just beside themselves. So I don't even know if that's a fair thing to tell a person. You can't unhear whatever you just heard.
Right.
But then the people would come back and inevitably they would forgive. And now they're all working together.
These courts were so interesting, right? Because they were grassroots. They were from the people. These courts were so community-based and forced the kind of humane confrontation that you're talking about. I'm looking in your eyes. So many of the cases were adjudicated in the community court, the cha-cha courts.
Yeah.
I find it so startling, given the ongoing legacy of what happened. There's sometimes when you forgive and, okay, I came to this moment, back to Mary Johnson, you would almost think when you see Mary and O'Shea together that nothing happened. You probably couldn't touch the moment of pain.
Mm-hmm.
But in Rwanda, there are children who were born. We're all looking now at the children of the rapes. Mm. All of those women, 250,000 of the women, the Tutsi women and the Hutu moderates, they're living legacies of the act of terror. And there's HIV. And how do people still forgive when you have to look at the result of the atrocity? Like I said, I'm startled.
I know. It's interesting to me when you think about how much structure we have around our legal system.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how many people come to any kind of internal peace in our process.
Yeah.
But then you have this very low structure system in Rwanda that seems to be delivering peace by the hundreds of thousands. That's really something.
I keep talking about what is divine and beyond us, but I do think that there is some element of forgiveness that is beyond this world. These women who are walking around raising children, working alongside people that they know deliberately killed their neighbor, their child, their spouse. It seems divine to me.
It's interesting to think about how in some cases, the surviving family member came to a place of pity for the genocide perpetrator. I had seen this very short film that the Nantucket Project made. This woman came to feel that his burden was in some ways worse than hers because something happened to her, but he did something. I know a guy also from the Nantucket Project who murdered his friend over 6 pounds of weed.
Wow.
Went to San Quentin for 17 years. And I'm very conscious of the burden he will carry till the day he dies.
Mm-hmm.
That's heavy,
that's
man.
That's heavy, right?
I mean, I must say, not to trivialize, but there have been times where I've lost my mind with my kids. Not recently, but when they're really little. And I've thought, oh my God, if there were like a nanny cam in the corner of this room.
Yeah, I'm done, right?
Dude, I'm in handcuffs. I'm out of there. This is insane. I totally lost my mind.
Yep.
And having lost my mind at some trivial level, which is to say screaming, helps me appreciate how a person could lose their mind at the next level. Mm-hmm. It does not help me appreciate how you could kill somebody. So then there's the story of Ishmael Beya, who I once did a reading with years and years ago with The Middle Place. And he wrote this book, Long Way Gone. He was a Sierra Leone boy soldier.
Yes.
And he talked about the drugs they would give him mm-hmm. and the psychological state that they would put them in. Mm-hmm. And that he had been convinced that he was on the side of goodness and that he was a savior.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of mind maybe could help a person appreciate how you got there, that you're so vulnerable to emotional and intellectual manipulation that you could actually get there. So this goes to a really interesting point that I think is woven into the idea of forgiveness, which I want to know what you think about. And that is humility.
Mm.
When I'm in a super righteous state, I use words like never and always. I would never do that. So I say, I would never do that. Can you imagine? I always, and it's all these like big blanket black and white statements that are probably not even true about myself, but in that moment, I'm utterly convinced that I am fundamentally different from the person that I'm judging.
Mm-hmm.
And then in my better moments, when I'm feeling more humble, I think I could do that. I could mm-hmm. be convinced. I could be incensed. I could be drugged and manipulated through some process and come out the other end willing to do horrific things. Do you believe that, or do you believe that there are some things you could not be convinced of under any circumstances?
I think the human mind is very, very powerful. Look at America. I think as we deal with what we have come to believe about other people, it is kind of a mental illness, right? To believe a story so much that you use that story to shape your worldview and you don't have the humility to think that you could be wrong. That is a theme for so much in our world. So yeah, I do believe people can be told those well-meaning initially, right? Rwandans, there was this mythology that people really believed. They really believed that they were supposed to extinguish this terrible group of people. So no humility, only brute strength, which led to atrocity. Afterwards, when things start to calm down, people then begin to come back to their humanity, to their humility. I think those words are really interesting in terms of connected human, humane, humility, you know?
Oh, yeah.
There's a root there.
And yeah, that's interesting.
I think people started to come back to themselves. Remember, I'm a child of the 70s, remember The Incredible Hulk?
Totally.
And remember when
totally.
He would start
great
to come
reference.
Back? Like, he would slowly walk down the street, and then he was this great guy with ripped clothes.
Yeah. But just shrinking.
He was shrinking, and his face would come back, and oh, the humility of saying, oh, I'm not the Hulk. I'm not that raging, out of control being.
That's actually a really deep show. I don't think I've ever thought about it since I watched it way back. Mm-hmm. That is what's happening to us, mm-hmm. is that we're hulking and de-hulking,
mm-hmm.
which goes back to your very interesting flag on human, humane, and humility,
mm-hmm.
which is to say the non-animal part of us,
mm-hmm.
the non-Hulk part of us, is that we have language and we have consciousness. We know we're having a thought. We know we can change that thought. And that's where we separate. And so I think acknowledging that there's a Hulk within us, mm-hmm. if you will.
And they perverted the part of us that is human in those little boys who became mm-hmm. soldiers. They really used story, a false one, to manipulate the brain to go into that state where you are no longer in touch. It's really insidious to make someone detach from their humanity by telling them something that puts them in this alternate state and causes them to do horrible things.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it happens quickly and sometimes it happens over time, because I bet you O'Shea didn't show up at that party to kill Mary Johnson's son.
Oh, no way. And I don't think she believes that.
Exactly.
We'll be right back with Wanda Holland Green talking about stories of astonishing forgiveness. Welcome back to Kelly Corrigan Wonders. This is a conversation about forgiveness with Wanda Holland Green. this goes to this whole larger thing about truth and reconciliation. One of the other things that Bryan Stevenson says, which I think is really interesting, he says, you know, like you can't walk 5 feet in South Africa without seeing some sort of representation of their shame. Mm. They're very public about it. Mm-hmm. And the same is true in Berlin. Never been to a place where a war is more present. Mm-hmm. That they would have a bombed out building in the middle of beautiful downtown Berlin that they're never going to take down because they never want people to forget that this can happen. Mm-hmm. You can get a lot of people believing a really bad story that can change their behavior.
That's exactly right.
Let me say one more thing. When I was in ninth grade at Radnor High School outside of Philadelphia, I had this history teacher, Sam Holt. And he said this thing in the beginning of the year, everything that I'm going to teach you this year, there's one theory behind all of it. And whenever you think you know it, raise your hand and say it. And if you get it before the end of the year, I'll give you an A.
Oh, that's cool.
Every 7 days or something, some kid would raise his hand and say, I think I know what it is. Religion causes wars. Some sort of overarching thing. And you'd say, no, that's not it. The thing was, what people believe changes the world.
Mm.
And what people believe is story.
That's it. Thank you, Mr. Holt.
When you go to Berlin and you see all the things that they will never remove, that they want all generations to be persistently reminded of, mm-hmm. that things can go very wrong. The worst, most evil part of us can be brought to the surface with enough work, enough story, enough organization, enough propaganda. Mm-hmm. We don't do that. And that's what's interesting right now about the civil rights movement that we're experiencing is this changing the narrative, mm-hmm. changing the statues.
Mm-hmm. And the monuments and the houses and the names of buildings. I think that this idea of facing your past, forgiving it and reconciling it, this whole act is one that has not been done in America. I think that is what we're seeing. We have this big homework assignment that's been sitting on the desk for mm-hmm. 400 plus years, right? The homework assignment is what to do about the legacy in this country. And because we have not made a collective decision to say we have been sold a bill of goods, there's this mythology that there's no impact on present day life from our past. I think America has a gigantic forgiveness project. You can call it reparations, you can call it reconciliation, but Bryan Stevenson would be the first to tell you we have not reckoned with the past. Looking at the past, forgiving what has happened, deciding that we were told that there's something really different about you if your skin is brown, and understanding that there's nothing in the way of us having that common ground we were talking about, except we have to look at this social construct and we have to decide this fiction that we were told and that's impacting everything we do, it's a social construct that needs to be reckoned with, but that there's actually no biological basis to any of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the hard part.
Mm-hmm.
That's the story that we haven't torn apart.
Yeah. It's the same thing with women. You know, victory in one area leads to victory in another, mm-hmm. as we were saying in mm-hmm. another podcast, but if you can't appreciate it, say you're a white lady like myself, mm-hmm. and you haven't lived it,
mm-hmm.
I've lived other things. Mm-hmm. I've lived knowing that somebody thought I was there to get them more coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm completely convinced that there's not one thing about women that is biologically relevant in a boardroom.
Right.
And I am completely convinced there's not one thing that is biologically relevant about a Black person in a boardroom.
Right.
Very easy to see that for me, but mm-hmm. I know it's not the same across the board. So that takes us to an interesting place, which is Christian Cooper. He's the birder mm-hmm. from Central Park, and he really loves birds. I don't think that he considers himself a civil rights activist. I think he's a kind of shy, introverted guy who really cares about migration patterns and really wants those dogs on leashes, so that the birds he loves so much will keep coming to that part of Central Park.
Right.
And that's just not that relatable.
Right.
It's so weird that that happened at the same time that George Floyd happened, because it almost obscured his truest identity, which is not as a Black man, but as a birder.
Mm-hmm.
That's how he thinks of himself. Mm. Please don't mess up this
beautiful
habitat.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, many people on both sides wanted a piece of him and wanted him to represent something, to be a lead character in mm-hmm. their story.
Yep.
And he said over many times that he was asked, that's not really what I'm about. He said in an op-ed in the Post that he thought it was a mistake to locate all that vitriol on a single person, that it wasn't worth ruining her life over, but it was worth having a big society-wide conversation, that would really be the outcome he would hope for, is for this woman in particular, whoopee, do some community service hours, be convicted of a false report for sure, have that on your record. But he doesn't want her to do jail time.
Mm-hmm.
He wants people to talk about it, that this is something that happens.
Yeah. We were talking about the power of the video camera. The downside is that it invites everybody to have an opinion about what you should and should not be doing. The upside is that it might invite people to continue to have conversations about race and use it as an object lesson, as opposed to being voyeurs on someone else's scene.
How is it that we can be convinced to go against whatever that small, pure voice within us is saying we should be doing?
Yep.
And that upstander, bystander thing is so relevant right now in America. Even like the choice to wear a mask or not, or let your kid go to a party or not,
mm-hmm.
or get on a plane when you don't really have to.
Mm-hmm.
All these are choices that are pitting your most selfish instincts against your sense of community and citizenship.
Yep, yep. And what are we willing to forgive, and what are we willing to move on from? It is the key to whether or not we will have a successful community in our future.
Yeah. And this is why Christian Cooper said, may we err on the side of compassion. That it was the only thing he could do in good conscience was encourage us to err on the side of compassion.
But back to this anger part, is that the arc of forgiveness? You have the anger, the vengeance, and all I can think of is you being put in a jail, metaphorically or actually. I want you locked up, and I'm going to keep you in that box, and I'm going to be angry, and then we've talked about humanity and humility and proximity and curiosity and looking at you. And then, you're a human.
Maybe I want something different
for
you.
Maybe I want something different for you and for me. Yeah.
I have a pretty vibrant, ongoing relationship with the people who subscribe to my newsletter. And I asked them about forgiveness. And a thing that came through from several people that was pretty devastating was parents who had been abusive. And that got me thinking about the difference between forgiveness, which according to this Medium thing I read, is a private thing, and reconciliation, which is a shared thing. And I thought that was pretty wise. The woman who wrote this article was a mental health counselor. Jocelyn St. Cyr is her name. And she drew this distinction because she was really wanting to encourage people to leave toxic relationships, but not put the rocks in your backpack for the rest of your life.
One of the things that I needed to do, just on a very personal level, is to understand that when a parent dies and there are unsaid things, that you can forgive someone who doesn't ask for it. I read a Mary Oliver poem called The Ponds at my mother's funeral, and it was the public moment of reconciliation. And my mom and I got along and didn't get along and got along and didn't get along, but there were some things unsaid that I'd wished that I'd said, and some moments of forgiveness that I needed to do for myself, but she was gone. So I had to share that moment through poetry. The lines are, but what in this world is perfect? I bend closer and see how this one is clearly lopsided, and that one wears an orange blight, and this one is a glossy cheek half nibbled away, and that one is a slumped purse full of its own unstoppable decay. We are all filled with unstoppable decay, right? We have a blight. We have an imperfection, and
that's the humility.
That's the humility, that imperfections are nothing and the light is everything. I think that's a big part of forgiveness, that compassion piece you're talking about, that reconciliation, which is shared and sometimes public. That's hard, but I think you have to get there.
Yeah. And I think one way that people often get there is to recognize that hurt people, which is to say, especially in sexual violence, the most perpetrators have also been victims.
Mm-hmm.
What this article was saying is, yes, you can appreciate how a person got f***ed up.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean you have to be around them.
Yep.
You can let it go inside yourself and never even tell them.
Yep.
You don't need to communicate your forgiveness.
Yep.
You can just experience it internally.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Just so you can move forward. The great prophet Oprah Winfrey once said, she said that forgiveness was giving up the idea that the past could have been any different.
That's really interesting.
I thought that was interesting. I used to run home at 4 o'clock. I don't know about you.
Yeah, oh yeah. I was a General Hospital kid.
Oh, so me too.
I came screeching into Oprah fresh off of Luke and Laura.
Oh, yes. Oh.
And I forgive myself. The last thing I want to talk about with this one is just forgiving yourself. And that's a trivial example, but I have wasted a colossal amount of time in my life.
Me too.
Every so often I meet a writer who has 6 books by the time they're 30.
Mm.
And I think, oh, my first book came out when I was 40 because I was like around on Union Street going to dollar pitcher nights, you know? And I got to forgive myself for that. And if I don't, if I stay in like a super judgy place, then it's really easy for me to be mad at my children for that.
Mm-hmm.
The days when I am super in touch with my own flaws, I am a much nicer, more compassionate mother.
Absolutely.
But it's a big 360. It's a big circular thing. If I'm judging them, I'm judging me too.
Yeah.
So Wanda, I have this kind of standing theory. It actually led to Tell Me More being written,
mm-hmm.
which is that Edward and I had this big debate about the difference between saying I'm sorry and saying I was wrong.
Ooh.
And it was my contention that saying I was wrong is so steeped in humility.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also putting us back on the same team, which is to say, if we can agree that this sort of behavior is wrong, then we are sort of repaired to go back together.
Mm-hmm.
Because we both agree. We both see it as right. We see right and wrong the same way. And that's very soothing.
That's incredible. Wrong is way down in the depths of your soul. When you said sorry and wrong, I immediately got some sort of layered feeling, like sorry was at one altitude, but I was wrong. Like that is a very healing word to say I was wrong.
And there's nothing more to say after that, at least in my marital spats, when he says, you're right, I was wrong. Oh, okay. Well, you want to have a roll in the hay? Or, what should we do now? Because I am set free. You just totally set me free. That's all I needed. We both have this religious background, and there's a big word that you say in church every week, which is trespassing.
As we forgive those who trespass against us.
Yeah. Has that been helpful for you or confusing?
Well, I didn't know what I was saying for like at least the first 14 years of my life because it's such an interesting word. To trespass means to be somewhere where you're not supposed to be, right?
Right. Yeah, I always thought it was, what do they think I'm going to do? Like jump the fence and go in a church parking lot?
Someone's grass you're standing on or you walked through a door that said exit, don't go through.
No trespassing.
But this idea of trespassing back to I was wrong means that you are on the wrong side.
Yeah.
You are in a space where you are in violation of someone else's sacred right to be safe. Because when you trespass, you're an interloper.
Mm-hmm.
You have crossed some line. There's the real moment there in that Lord's Prayer that we all were taught to recite. Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. So what you learn very early on, if you're in a Christian church, is that your ability to be forgiven by others or by God is directly correlated to your humility in forgiving others. And you can't get one without the other.
So it's actually a very helpful thing to reflect on, even though I don't say the Lord's Prayer much these days.
Neither do I. I think about karma, and I think about what I put out into the world. And I think if we lack humility and are unforgiving, then it might be more likely that we're not creating the conditions in our own lives to be forgiven.
Oh my God. There's so many times when this is very embarrassing and I hope Edward doesn't listen to it, but there's times when Edward will be talking. We've been married 20 years. I really love him. I don't want to be married to anyone else ever, but he will be boring me. And then all I have to do to like release from it is think, oh, you probably bore him every bit as much, if not more.
Mm-hmm.
So just pretend exactly. that you're listening. It's
just,
fine.
Just please. Nod and smile. Yeah.
And then what happened? Ooh. But it's the same with kids. I often remind both my daughters, if they're frustrated by something someone does, I say, oh, well, she's probably not so thrilled when you do X. So mm-hmm. everybody's got to give a little here. But it's interesting because our nature is working against us.
Mm.
Because evolutionarily, it would be better to remember vividly threats and harms.
Yep.
Such that you don't repeat them. And there isn't really much value to holding on to the lovely things. So mm-hmm. I remember seeing once that for every negative thing someone says, you have to say five to counterbalance it. I mean, I have to really remind myself to give my kids positive feedback
mm-hmm.
at a 5-to-1 rate.
Mm-hmm.
You could get from one end of the day to the other and only say, did you pick up your towel? Did you lock the door? What time are you going out? Did you put the gas in the car? Don't forget to put it in the garage.
Mm-hmm.
The numerator is nagging mm-hmm. and there's zero denominator.
Yes. And we all know that we call those improper fractions.
Yes, that's right. That is an improper fraction.
Improper.
I love that.
I go back to that moment when you asked me, Kelly, did I have a list of people whom I have not forgiven? And as I said then, I'm not proud of that moment of honesty and clarity, but maybe it's about protecting. The brain is doing that because I'm reminding myself what bites, what yes. poisons the body.
Yes.
And I wonder what it would take to drop the self-protection and to have the compassion to know and the faith to know that those people won't bite again.
The key distinction is forgiveness doesn't mean reconciliation.
Indeed. I could just forgive them and be freer and not be plotting their demise in my
mind. But still be out of relationship.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. That's got to be one of the choices on the multiple choice test. Forgive, forgive and forget, forgive and separate. Those are the three choices.
Yeah. Or D, none of the above. No, I'm just kidding. No.
There she is, our healthy role model, Wanda Holland Green.
I think it's one of the gifts that we can give ourselves to not should ourselves to death and create these expectations that are often impossible. Kelly, I think the hard part about life is that by the time you really start feeling like you get the hang of it, your head is half over.
Easily halfway.
Right. And so the best that we can do is live forward and not have regret be on our coattails every day and to say, I now know better. I have lessons. I maybe should have forgiven that thing sooner. Could have been more productive, but I'm flawed. I'm imperfect. And I think that's the humility to know that we were never actually meant to get it right the whole time.
Totally. And that's super contagious. Mm-hmm. If I give myself that allowance, I'm going to give it to my kids.
Right.
And they deserve it as much as I do.
Absolutely. Particularly now when everything seems so out of whack and out of order.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks, Wanda.
Thank you. So wonderful to be with you.
Do you have a beautiful note to go out on?
I'll read the last two lines of Mary Oliver's The Ponds because it is, for me, the ultimate poem about forgiveness. I want to believe I am looking into the white fire of a great mystery. I want to believe that the imperfections are nothing, that the light is everything, that it is more than the sum of each flawed blossom rising and fading. And I do.
Mm, thank you. All right, let's take a brief break and we'll be right back with Kelly Corrigan Wonders. Hey, this is Kelly Corrigan, and with me now is Dacher Keltner. He is a big-time academic and a professor at UC Berkeley, and he's also the co-founder of something called the Greater Good Science Center, which is a go-to source for me. Dacher, I wanted to talk to you about forgiveness.
It's a great topic, Kelly. Thanks.
The first thing I want to say is I get granting forgiveness to someone who comes forward with a sincere mea culpa.
Yeah.
But why would we and how could we ever forgive someone who hasn't apologized?
Yeah. You know, that's such a striking question because the literature on forgiveness, the scientific literature, is you need an apology that has certain properties.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, you know, good.
That the person needs to
feel validated,
admit it and accept responsibility, acknowledge harm, and then you forgive. And, you know, one question that arises, like, what if somebody has been sexually abusing me and they apologize? Do you have to forgive? And no, you don't. You're asking another complicated question, which is, what if that person just never apologizes, right? And I think that the wisdom I've heard in, you know, sort of talking about this with thousands of people is you got to do it for yourself, right? If you've been harmed and you feel the agitation around that harm of cortisol and stress and it wakes you up and you ruminate and you can come to a place where you forgive them in a almost a metaphysical way, like, God, humans make horrible mistakes. Even if they haven't apologized and it feels good to you, you should do that, right?
For just for the physiological relief.
Yeah. And the same is true of not forgiving, which is if someone really is begging for an apology and you can't, after some contemplation, find the place to do it, you shouldn't do it.
God, even if you're just going to stew on it, like, it's so hard to let these thoughts go. You could just cycle forever. For years, you could lose sleep over, like, replaying something in your mind or fantasizing about the conversation that you're never going to have.
I know, and that's where, in some sense, ironically, someone who's been harmed has to think of their own self-interest, right? Like, where will you be best in your stance toward the person who's harmed you?
Right. In other words, what will let you sleep? What will lower your cortisol? What will give you those like critical beats of relief?
Yeah, well put.
What happens if we give people free rides? Like, won't everything just go to hell?
I do. There is a really striking new literature in what you might call behavioral economics. And there's this general deep worry about free riders who, you know, exploit other people, aren't punished, and take other people's resources or lie or act immorally. And we have all kinds of systems that emerge to track those people, you know, legal systems, punitive systems, really primitive systems in the Middle Ages where you put somebody in the town square and lock them up, right? More informal systems like gossip. And we've done work showing people gossip about free riders. Like, hey, that guy never does the dishes, you know? And so, yeah, it is bad news for our very communal species if we're not punishing a bit and watching out for people who exploit.
And punishment works? Or no? Like, I mean, I'm so surprised to hear myself sort of on the side of being punitive.
Yeah.
Like, that doesn't feel like it's in line with how I generally think. But is it effective?
I don't know the literature on what kinds of punishment work when it gets to putting people into prison, you know, do those punishments work? And that's a deep debate. I've been more devoted to the informal punishments of everyday life.
Like harm to your reputation and such?
Exactly. And gossip. Gossip's a form of punishment. Like, ooh, I just got gossiped about. I feel the sting. And, you know, there are studies showing if I'm worried about my reputation and if I know people can gossip about me, I behave better. Mm. And so it tells us we need a little bit of punishment in social systems to rein in the bullies and the people who abuse others, right? And I think the sexual harassment case is one of the things that came out of all of the Me Too analysis is you end up having these people who surround the abuser that don't punish him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't say, man, you're out of line or you should be fired or et cetera. And that enables the problematic behavior.
Mm-hmm. So which is greater, our natural inclination for revenge, which is there, right? That's a true thing. Or our natural inclination to forgive?
Oh, my God.
I only bring you the hard questions. I'm sorry. It's called Stump the Chump with Dacher Keltner.
Wait, did you just call me a chump?
I don't know. I think I did by accident. I think I may have.
Because I am stumped.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I always go back to, in a funny way, you look at first our nervous system.
Uh-huh.
And we know we both have very young kids and adults around the world. We'll both forgive and also seek revenge in really startling ways. So it's kind of half and half.
Mm.
And then you look at what people do out in their social behaviors, right? And both are very powerful tendencies. And I think that that always challenges us. And, you know, it's interesting. A lot of people feel like we're given these tendencies, the instinct toward revenge, which is real, and the instinct toward forgiveness. Franz de Waal has this amazing finding, what he calls reconciliation. All mammals will reconcile and forgive, except one species. Guess what it is?
I don't know.
The domesticated cat.
Oh, really?
They are absolutely
God, I knew it.
Blind
knew
to forgiveness.
It.
Yeah. For all
They're
you dog
so
fans.
So cold. They're so cold.
But Franz's point is, man, this is mammalian. So both are
That's
there.
That's amazing.
I know. I know. He's wonderful. But what it tells us is, and there are data on this, that if you do the hard work of forgiveness, you know, if you forgive somebody who's harmed you at work or had an extramarital affair or really said something nasty and you're a teenager in front of your friends and you find forgiveness, your relationships fare better. So I would say
other relationships, like even relationships that are unrelated to that one.
Yeah, yeah. So
that's a pretty big reward.
So I would say we're granted with both in terms of our natural inclinations. And then the hard work is to veer toward forgiveness.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Dacher.
You're welcome, Kelly.
Well, suffice to say, I took pages of notes on this episode. Here are my top 9 takeaways, and no need to pull over the car or write on your hand. They'll always be posted on medium.com/@Kelly. Okay, here's my top 9. 1, forgiveness is a slippery state. In any given scenario, we will probably be required to achieve it repeatedly over time. 2, humility is forgiveness's twin emotion. In other words, if you're pretty sure you're entirely innocent, that you've never been selfish, greedy, or had other dips in character, if you're a person who says things like, I would never, and I have always, you are probably a person who is less likely to forgive. 3, assume all of us have the Hulk within us. 4, time and curiosity help. Time to sit with the wrong, to study it, to suffer it fully, and to get sick of it. And curiosity, how, why, what don't you know? Just asking those questions will get you closer to forgiveness. 5, proximity is a factor here. As Wanda said, if you're curious and you're proximate, watch out because you're about to be transformed. 6, people with a growth mindset have a better chance to live outside of anger on permanent repeat. 7, forgiveness does not necessarily mean reconciliation. You can forgive someone and walk away forever at the very same moment. 8, righteousness is a dangerous buzz. It can rally a movement, yes, but solutions require a different emotional state, something in the neighborhood of calm determination. And 9, America has a gigantic forgiveness project in front of us. You can call it reparations, you can call it reconciliation. You can cook up another term for it altogether, but the work is ours to do. I wanna thank Wanda Hollengreen as ever. I wanna thank Dacher Keltner. Thanks, guys. We'll see you online at medium.com/@Kelly.